The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Oh, good evening. And so I thought I would, we'll try to continue this series last evening, this three-part series on Buddhism and nonviolence or peace. And I thought I would tell you a few stories first. Some are kind of complete stories, brief but complete, and some I want to tell you half of it and not the outcome, and then talk for a while and we'll get back to the outcome of the story. So the first time that I can remember that I, maybe the only time I can remember I really slugged someone was when I was six. And I was in a new school, and I was being chased by older boys in the playground. So I remember I stopped, I turned around, and I hit one of them in the face. And then I ran to one of the teachers. And then I was left alone. And that was, you know, a kind of successful outcome. I'm still here to tell you the story. And then I tried again to slug someone when I was 14. There was someone I was in boarding school, and there was an older boy who was being kind of mean to me, teasing me and stuff, and it reached a point where it just seemed like this was not good. And so I remember in the hallway in the dormitory turning around to hit him. And the next thing I knew, I was on the floor. So that was a successful outcome for him, maybe. It wasn't for me. And then when I was about, I was 21, I did the kind of thing that if you do it, often another man will want to beat you up. So I was, I remember I was driving a tractor across a field. I was, I don't know, I was mowing or plowing or something, and this man came walking across the field, fists, angry. It's clear that he was coming for me. So I got off the tractor and waited, and walked up to me and said, "Okay, we're going to fight." And then about, must be now more than 15 years ago, 17 years ago, I was living on the corner of Haight and Laguna in San Francisco, in the lower Haight. And a block away up the hill were these housing projects. A lot of violence there and stuff, drugs. And then this, one day I was standing quite near the corner there, and this old car came down from the projects, careening down Haight Street. So that's kind of squealing and careening, and this, you know, didn't seem like a good scene. So we're kind of, what's this about? And it came into the middle of the intersection and kind of made a sharp turn in the middle of the intersection and stopped in the middle of that intersection. And the back door opened, and this woman tumbled out and kind of walked out into the middle of the intersection. And so, and these then these two big, tough-looking football player size to me, they looked like dangerous guys. Got out of the car too to go get her. So that's the story. And a And one more story. This is not from my life, but I read it this weekend in Tricycle magazine, and it kind of impressed me, the story. And it concerns a man who's taught here, sat in the seat and taught, a man named Vinny Ferraro. He's one of the leaders of the Dharma Punk Dharma scene in the San Francisco, leads a sitting group up there. Wonderful man. Full of tattoos and such things. And he grew up on the East Coast in a very poor neighborhood. His father was in jail for drugs. Father taught him how to deal drugs when he was a little kid. Grew up with gangs. When he was 15, the custom was if they found strangers in their turf, they would beat them up. And they found a homeless man in their neighborhood. And they went to beat him up. As the story said, they started beating him up. And the man looked up at Vinny and said, "Help me." And Vinny said, "Why should I?" What would you say if you were beating someone up and they said, "Help me"? Or what would you say if you were being beat up and they said, "Why should I help you?" So what would you do in all these circumstances? I remember when I was about 20 or so, I was a long-haired hippie traveling across the United States, and naively went into a, or I don't know, naively, went into a bar in the Florida Panhandle. And when I walked into the bar with my friend, the tension in the room got pretty dramatic. I thought, uh-oh, am I going to get out of here in one piece? Because, I mean, the daggers in the eyes and the tension was pretty intense. So what do? And I can go on with stories. I might just think so on my own stories. I remember once when I was about 15 or so, being out at night in the streets of Italian city called Trieste, and there was probably a Croatian young man, old, just maybe he was 17 or 18, who was there, and I was just leaning against the wall doing nothing, and he came up to me and threw a fist at me, right in my face. What do you do? What do you do in these circumstances? What do you do when there's violence? What do you do if when you're the recipient of violence? What do you do when there's threat? What do you do when you're the perpetrator of violence? When you're going to hurt someone? What do you do in all these circumstances? And, you know, most of you, I think, look like very nice people. I don't worry too much about you being violent to me tonight. Are you capable of violence? The last time that I really wanted to slug someone was when I was 30, I must have been about 31. Now I think that's the history of my wanting to slug someone. You're getting the whole thing. I have full confession. I can't think of any other times that I can remember. But 6, 15, 31. I was 31. But I tell you this story because I was a monk in a monastery, Zen monastery in Japan. Now that's, you don't think of monks wanting to slug someone, you know, and it happened when I was sitting meditating. And I wanted to hit the man next to me because he really didn't like me. And he would sit, we would sit there meditating and he would poke me and pull on my robes and you know, he would do mean things here and there. And at some point I said, you know, so at one point, I remember one moment, I just felt like I was going to... And, but I didn't, luckily. That would not have been a good scene to have slugged him there in the meditation hall. Later, in the same monastery, I came across a monk being beat up by two of the other monks. What do I do when I see that? What do I do? I remember there was actually one more time where I kind of thought of wanting to slug someone. I guess I'm a dangerous guy. I think I was about 11 or 12, 11, maybe 11, 10 or 11, something like that, maybe 11, 10. And I was in a train in Italy with my mother and my younger sister. And my mother was then, at that point, I guess she was about 31, blonde, and beautiful looking. And this Italian soldier got into the train compartment with us and started flirting with her. So I was sitting next to the soldier, and I said to my mother in Norwegian, so he couldn't understand, I said to him, you know, and I put it in my fist, I held my fist aside, so he couldn't see it, next to me like this, you know, on the side of my body. So the soldier couldn't see it, my mom could see it. And I said, you know, should I? She said no. So, you know, violence. You know, it seems like it comes off my history pretty easily. Like, I can think of all these things that I've done and situations I've been in and how easy it is. And you think that we're all kind of people like who are monks, after all. You think that in the midst of their spiritual practice, you think they'd be kind of like be well-behaved. And even there, I was capable of feeling these feelings. So is it something that we need to address and look at for ourselves? Is something we have, do we have the capacity within us? And if we do, then is it something we want to meet and face and address and deal with? And do we, if we do address it in some deep way in ourselves, do we address it just for ourselves, or do we also address it for the sake of others? Because if someone doesn't address these issues in their hearts and their minds, you know, how do we expect anybody else to do it? And there's certainly plenty of violence. There's a story from the time of the Buddha. It seems like, my impression is the Buddha was a grand story maker, storyteller. And, you know, the impression is that he made up stories. That's my impression. But anyway, he tells a story of when a battle was raging between the Devas and the Asuras. Devas are like gods. And the Asuras are sometimes called titans or jealous titans. They're these kind of like godlike beings, and they're very jealous of the gods. The gods have it pretty good. I don't know how the titans have it. These Asuras, but the Asuras always fight, trying to fight the gods. So that each of the gods and the Asuras each have a ruler, and the rulers confront each other and they say, this time around, let's have a battle of words. So they're going to do a debate, in other words. And so they agree to this debate. And the Asura, this jealous titan, starts off by saying, "The foolish grow ever more angry if there is no one to stop them. Therefore, let a strong person restrain the fool with a firm and sharp reproof." The foolish grow ever more angry if there is no one to stop them. So perhaps the foolish people who are fooled into being violent, for example, you have to stop them. And you have to stop them firmly and strongly with your strength. Sharp reproof. Now the king of the devas replies, "It is my persuasion that the only way to curb a foolish person is for the alert-minded to cultivate calm and stillness when another is filled with rage." So you get the debate? And then the Asura says, "I see a serious mistake in what you so patiently endure. When a fool thinks that person tolerates me out of fear, the fool will continue to attack. Like an ox that charges as you flee." So I see a serious mistake if you patiently endure. The fool will continue to attack. Well, I want to tell you another story. If I may, tell stories, partial stories. Many years ago, I was teaching a retreat, and this woman came for an interview, and she told me that she had been a civil rights activist, I guess, during the civil rights time, a white woman from the north who had gone down to the south, and she had stood on a street corner to protest the discrimination of the time. And these angry rednecks came along in a pickup truck, jumped out of the pickup truck, and started beating her up. That's the part of the story. What would you do? In that circumstances, what would you do? So according to the Asura, you would fight back and show that person a piece of your mind, because if you don't fight back, if you patiently endure the violence, then they'll just get more violent and do you in or something. But the Deva says, no, you should cultivate calm and stillness when another is filled with rage. So then the Deva goes on and says, the Asura said, "I see a serious mistake in what you so patiently endure. When a fool thinks that person tolerates me out of fear, the fool will continue to attack. Like an ox that charges as you flee." Then the Deva said, "Let the fool think whatever. In cultivating the highest goal, nothing compares to patience, and the highest form of patience is to tolerate the weakness and shortcomings of others. Whoever thinks that the strength of fools is strength will claim a strong person to be a weakling. For it will not occur to a strong person protected by virtue to exchange words of anger. Worse off is the one who, when reviled, reviles back. But whoever does not revile when reviled wins a twofold victory. The strong seek the best for themselves and for others. Understanding another's anger, they cultivate calm and stillness. And thus they heal both themselves and the others. Those who call this weakness do not understand the Dharma." Anyway, so they won the debate because their logic or their beauty of their verses. It was done in poetry. So there's arguments one side or the other for the value of violence, the importance of it, protecting your family, protecting yourself, certainly, getting your way, curbing someone else in some way. It needs to be curbed. And then there's arguments the other way, that there's value in developing calmness and stillness, and maybe another approach. So I wanted to complete some of these stories now. So my friend who was going to came to fight me for good cause, I'd done something, came storming across the field. I got down off my tractor And as he approached, he said, you know, as he approached, I don't know, the instinct took over, I suppose. And I bent down on one knee. And he said, let's fight. And I opened up my arms to my side, my hands like this, and said, I can't. On my knees. He turned around in disgust and marched off. That was successful for me. That worked out well, I thought. I wasn't going to fight him. But it would come what may. I knew I couldn't. The story of Vinny, the homeless man's being beat up and says, help me. And Vinny says, why should I? And the homeless man, as the story goes, as Vinny accounts it in the tricycle, this issue of tricycle, he looks up at Vinny and he says, when I look into your eyes, I see more compassion there than in any woman I've ever met. That was the end of the beating. And that changed Vinny's life. Perhaps because the man saw something in Vinny they had never seen in himself. He says in the article that his father kind of drummed out his feelings, like he wasn't supposed to feel and be aware of feelings. Just be tough, I guess. And that kind of got him. Ended, so that was successful, ending of the beating. Very successful, changed his life for the better. Now he's a Dharma teacher. And what other unfinished stories did I tell you? Forget all these stories. Yeah.
Or the car going down hate.
Oh, the car going down hate. So this woman's there in the middle of hate and Laguna. So I walked up there into the middle of the intersection and stood between her and these big guys. And kind of protect her. I didn't know what the story was going on. And she wasn't running away, but it was clear she didn't want to go back in the car. What did she want to do with these guys? But these guys were big. So they kind of said, I don't forget what they said to me, but they really, you know, they said, she's with us. And they would take a couple of steps towards me. So I would take a couple of steps back. They take a couple of steps towards me, and I take a couple of steps back. So that was the dance. It wasn't that successful, I thought. But then this other man came along and walked up to the middle intersection, and he said to the two guys, you know, if I was in the situation of this woman, I wish someone would come and stand up for me. Or I wish that you would come and stand up for me. And that cooled the whole thing down. And the whole thing mellowed. So I wasn't the one who said that. I was the one who was just doing this dance, backing up. So that was nice. So violence wasn't needed because somehow empathy or common kind of care for each other was evoked in a way that was meaningful for these two guys.
The bar in the south?
The bar in the south. Well, it turned out my friend that I was with was a natural comedian. And within, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes, he had everyone in the bar laughing. And so we got out of there safely. I didn't have the ability to be a comedian, but humor was used to diffuse the situation. Like, you know, that was quite something. So I told that story about the bar because that there's so many different ways of meeting and addressing violence and the threat of violence. And some of them are quite creative. I remember a friend of mine was being mugged by some teenage boys up there by the projects in San Francisco. And they wanted his money or something. I don't know if they had a knife or what they had, but they wanted his money. And he turned to them and said, "Your mother would be ashamed of you." So they left him alone. Oh, the activist in the civil rights time. So she was standing there in the corner, she tells me, and she was, these guys jumped out of the pickup truck and started beating her up and the other people protesting with her. Beat them up some. Then they left. So the next day, the civil rights protesters went to the same corner and did the same protest. Same guys came along, jumped out of their pickup truck and beat them up again. They went back a third day to the same place and stood there. And they jumped, the same thing happened, the guys jumped out of the pickup truck. And she tells the story to me, she said, "So I was there and this guy had his fist ready to hit me. And he looked into my eyes and he said, 'What in the world are you doing?' And then we had a conversation. That was the end of the violence. They had a conversation. I don't know what the outcome of the conversation, but in that conversation of these two opposing, you know, people, in a sense opposing, wouldn't have happened if she'd fought back, or wouldn't have happened if she'd run away. So I would like that story because, you know, some of you have been the recipients of violence, been the receiving end, probably. It's a big enough room here, I'm sure, some of you. Some of you, it might have been horrific, some of you experienced. I don't want to belittle it at all. I'd like to end it, the kind of violence. But are there some situations where the wisest, the most, or the, well, not wisest, but a fantastic, appropriate response is to sit there and just receive it? And perhaps in that situation, civil rights, there was lots of examples. That's what the civil rights protesters were trained to do, was to receive violence passively. Not because they're supposed to be passive, you know, and just, you know, but rather because they were kind of soldiers. They were courageously and fiercely trying to change a nation. And in that context, their standing there and receiving it was a very powerful thing to do. And they were trained, some of them were trained, you know, to understand that. So Martin Luther King said, "The ultimate weakness of violence is that it is a descending spiral, begetting the very thing it seeks to destroy. Instead of diminishing evil, it multiplies it. Through violence, you may murder the liar, but you cannot murder the lie, nor establish the truth. Through violence, you may murder the hater, but you do not murder hate. In fact, violence merely increases hate. So it goes. Returning for violence, returning violence multiplies violence, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Light can do that. Hate can never drive out hate. Only love can do that." And then the last little teaching from the Buddha that I want to share, a couple of things here, if I may. One is just a very, I think for me, a very significant teaching or verse from the Buddha. Victory gives birth to hate. The defeated sleeps tormented. Giving up both victory and defeat, the peaceful sleep delighted. And that verse with between the gods and the asuras, it says, "The strong seek the best for themselves and for others." So how in the situation of violence or anger or conflict do we not see it as a win-lose situation? How do we not see it as only as a negative thing, as something that's terrible and bad? How do we see conflict as something where maybe, you know, how do we look at conflict, conflicted situation, and have our concern be, what's good, what's the best for everyone concerned here? What's the way forward here for everyone that works, as opposed to just for me, how I can be safe, or whatever. And but the context here, it says, in cultivating the highest goal, nothing compares with patience. The highest goal in Buddhism is liberation. And for the people who are interested in liberation, the monks and nuns that the Buddha was training, he had something very dramatic to say to them. And maybe this is kind of. Anyway, I'll just read it. So he's talking to his disciples, monks and nuns. Even if hoodlums were to cut off your limbs, if you become hateful toward them, you would not be carrying out my teachings. Rather, you should practice. Our hearts will remain unaffected. We will say nothing evil. We will maintain compassion for that being's well-being. We will maintain loving kindness and a heart free of hate. We shall practice suffusing the person with our heart filled with loving kindness. After doing so to this person, we will practice suffusing the entire world with our heart filled with immeasurable loving kindness. This is how you should practice. That's pretty dramatic. It's fantastic, isn't it? Someone's cutting off your arms, and you're supposed to have kindness towards them. It can seem extreme, perhaps it's extreme to make a point. Some people read this and are horrified. You mean you're supposed to not defend ourselves if someone's attacking you this way? It doesn't say no defense. What it says is no hate. And monks are, in fact, allowed to do very mild forms of defense, as mentioned last week, where they can do simple forms of pushing away or striking out against someone in order to escape from danger. But the rule is that they cannot do it if there's any anger or ill will. If you're able to fend off an attacker without any ill will, then a monk or nun is not breaking the rules. But it's kind of dramatic. But this is in the context of people going for the highest good, the highest liberation, the highest peace. If that's what you want, then I think the demand, or not the demand, but the need for living a nonviolent life becomes much higher, because it's impossible to go for the highest goal of liberation, of freedom, of peace in the heart, and still be motivated or still act in violent ways or out of anger in your heart. It's impossible. So for the people interested in that goal, I think that it makes sense to look at how can I enter the conflict, whether it's ordinary conflict with others or more violent conflict, how can I enter it, how can I be with it in a way that makes it into a path of practice, that makes it so the wisest, most compassionate part of me comes out. And part of that has to do with how we prepare ourselves. And Buddhism has made a big issue over the centuries that we need to prepare ourselves by cultivating a really clear intention about what we want our life to be about. And so that intention is ready to support us in times of difficulty. If the intention is one of being nonviolent, the intention is one of being peaceful, the intention is to look for the highest good for everyone concerned. If that's cultivated and developed, not in an abstract kind of Pollyannish kind of way, but really it's kind of like the foundation of what we want our life to be about, then it becomes ready for us, hopefully ready, to be activated and used when it's most needed. But if we haven't prepared ourselves and cultivated that intention, then it'll slip away when we're under stress, and other forces inside of us will take over. We prepare ourselves by practicing mindfulness. I think one of the very best trainings for being in conflict in a way that is useful for everyone concerned is to have the capacity to stay mindful in conflict, to be really attentive to what's happening, attentive to ourselves, attentive to others, to learn how to listen. Where the default in conflict is not to attack, not to run away, but the default is pay attention. Slow down if you can. What's going on here? And I've been in many situations where I was angry and wanted to say something, but I waited and paid attention. And it made a huge, huge radical difference to listen, to wait, to pay attention to myself, what was going on inside, my feelings, my reactions, my beliefs, and pay attention to what's out there. And sometimes paying attention, I've learned, has to take the form of asking questions. And asking questions in conflict is one of the best things, I think. It slows it down. What do you mean? You're going to punch me? What do you mean? Well, how's that? What's that about? Anything at all. I think one of the things that people need the most when they're in conflict is they need to be heard. They need to be heard and need to be understood. Even when you have the right and the other person has the wrong, let the other person who's wrong, let them be heard and understood. It's probably what they need the most. One of the most dangerous things, I think, or very terrible things, like putting match to gasoline, is to be self-righteous and right. So listen. Listen by asking questions. And then part of what we listen to is what's going on in us. Are we reactive? Meaning, are these impulses, habits of lashing out or closing down, operating? And then to see that, to watch how that mind does that, and then having learned how not to give in to those forces. So you might find yourself closing down in conflict. Some people have the closing down instinct. And to see that, know that really well, and in spite of that feeling wanting to close down, to stay open, to stay connected, find out what's going on. Or you want to run away. Everything in you says run away, but you stay. Or you want to hit or lash out or say something that kind of hurts someone. But you can see that reaction coming, and you see you don't give into it. You hold your tongue. In times of crisis or very dramatic situations, it's not an easy thing to do. And so my understanding is that my belief is it's very important to prepare yourself. Sooner or later, there'll be conflict. And one of the best preparations that I know of is mindfulness. Practice mindfulness, like in meditation. And learn all about your reactions and how you react. It'll all come visit you as you sit and meditate, sooner or later. It's all going to come through. Maybe it's going to be mild, but you'll learn the territory. You'll learn how you react and respond and what goes on. And so you should look, when you meditate, you should look for days. You should meditate, definitely meditate in days when you're in conflict with people and angry or afraid. It's so important. If you only meditate when you feel good, you know, you're not preparing yourself. You're not learning who you are. You're not learning how to work with the reactions and responses. You're not learning how to keep yourself calm or centered in situations that are going to be difficult. So look at yourself. So practice mindfulness. Look at your intention. And then finally, if you want to be peaceful or a force of peace, not just peaceful, but a force for peace in the world, I think it's important not to have just a belief in peace, an idea that it's useful, but to have cultivated a sensitivity for peace, where the motivation, the impulse for creating peace or being peaceful in a situation is not logical, but it comes as part of the the wish of your heart, in a sense, the inner wish, the inner kind of sensitivity. This is the right thing. This is appropriate. Because if it's just an idea, it probably won't radiate very far. And it won't be very creative. And I think to be able to meet conflict and be present for it and find the solution for everyone, so there's not winner or losers, it takes a lot of creativity. And that creativity, I think, rides best on the instinct for it to be peaceful, or the feeling that being peaceful is kind of like what you most want, or the compassion that wants peace. It doesn't work. It doesn't ride very well on the logic. Oh, it's a good idea to be peaceful. I should be peaceful. That's what So, and that instinct or that sensitivity for peace and compassion, I think, comes when we are practice something like mindfulness and meditation, and have had an experience of letting the preoccupied mind, the distracted mind, fall away. When the crusts and the resistance and the of our hearts kind of fall away, and the natural sensitivity and softness of the heart is what can feel and experience the world. And then the task is not to just be soft and sensitive, but to be soft, sensitive, and strong. And the story of the woman who was a civil rights protester, I would say that she was, I don't know how soft and sensitive she was, but she certainly was strong. You have to be very strong. She probably was stronger than the people beating her up. That's why it worked. So in sum, as I said, the first evening of this series, there's an ancient Buddhist saying that the characteristic of the Dharma, the characteristic quality of the Dharma, is non-violence, is non-harming. That the Dharma and non-harming are intimately connected. And if you're interested in Dharma practice, you should also be interested in non-harming. So, that's what I have to say tonight. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for listening.